Welcome to Bad Science, the show that breaks down the science of a movie with a comedian and a scientist. Today we're discussing 2005's Madagascar, so I'll ask about biodiversity, lemurs, and hopefully one of our guests will sing I Like to Move It. But first, a short word from our sponsor.
Bad Science. Did the movie get it right? Bad Science. Or will we have to fight?
Hi everyone, I'm your host Ethan Edinburgh, and I've got two wonderful guests joining me today. First up, she's a decision scientist and conservation planner at the Nature Conservancy and the Center for Biodiversity and Global Change at Yale University. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jennifer McGowan.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you here. Your first podcast.
That is true.
This is monumental. Sound the alarms.
I agree. It's like kind of a little bit nervous, a little bit anxious. I'm like, do I have my facts right? Probably not, but you know, we'll see how we go.
Excellent. And I assume to prepare, you also, you know, you did like 3-4 shots of tequila, or like you pounded a cold brew or something.
Definitely. And listened to Reel to Reel on repeat at least 17 times.
I hope we spend a lot of time talking about You Like to Move It by Reel to Reel. So I wanted to ask you before getting going here, you've trained hundreds of scientists to use the world's leading spatial planning decision support tool, which is called Markson, if I have that correct. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So I'm a decision scientist, which is kind of a weird title. But basically what it means is I help people, governments, NGOs around the world figure out what actions they can take in space and time to save biodiversity and other things that they care about. So basically, I pull together a little bit of ecology, mathematics, operations research, economics, and we put it all together and try and inform smart decision making. And so a big part of that is training and capacity building, because it's not something that everyone has expertise in. And so I was very lucky to spend the last 7 years. I got to travel to, I don't know, over 20 countries or so, and work on actual applied serious of consequence conservation projects. So it's been wow. Remarkable, and it's thrilling, and it's depressing, and it's challenging, but we plod on.
Well, Jennifer, it's truly an honor to have you on the show. I feel like I'm talking to a superhero right now. Like, you're the person that, like, in a movie, the president will call in to help him make a decision or her make a decision, and it's like a job that I don't believe exists, where I'm like, what? We don't have an expert in all of these things that just helps people make decisions, but that does exist in reality, and it's what you do.
Yeah, it is. I don't know if I'm a superhero. I'll take it, though. Hey.
It sounds like it. But speaking of superheroes, I got to introduce our next guest. He is an actor and writer who appeared on our Air Bud episode back in December of 2019, and you may know him from the improvised musical podcast Off Book. It's Zach Reno.
Sound the alarms. Here I am.
Sound the alarms, baby.
You said that when you were introducing Jennifer, and I was like, Ethan, you don't sound alarms when a good thing is happening.
No, I feel like it's like the beginning of that Christina Aguilera song where they're going, sound the alarms. And it's like, because this song is about to happen.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, I tend to equate alarms with, you know, get to a tsunami shelter.
Right, something's wrong.
Someone has broken into my home.
Well, listen, Zach, sound the alarms because you're in the house today.
I'm so happy to be here, Ethan. And I'm so happy to have Googled all of the lyrics to I Like to Move It. However many you think there are more.
There's more. It's so true. I listened to the entire song for the first time probably ever. I don't know if I've heard the entire song before today.
I have not. There are lyrics in that I'm looking at here that I can say with 100% certainty have never passed my ears before.
And Dr. Jennifer McGowan, that's a good first question to you. Have you ever listened to I Like to Move It in its entirety?
No, but I was trying to prepare for this by going into a Wikipedia wormhole on lemurs, and I ended up just getting distracted by the wormhole of Reel to Reel. And in 1994, it was on the Billboard Hot 100, and it was like number one in France and the Netherlands, which as a scientist, I just simply can't explain.
That wow. That makes sense to me, because you guys know the story behind I Want It That Way, right?
No.
The Backstreet Boys song?
So the Backstreet Boys song, the I Want It That Way, is a filler lyric written by Swedish people. They were like, it's going to be something like this, but English is their second language, and it doesn't really mean anything. And they wrote like three versions of lyrics to replace it, but never found something as catchy as that. So they just left it. And I Like to Move It is not filler lyric, but it's so simple that like, I get why it would be number one in a foreign country. Or the same way like Macarena, right? It's like, it's not about liking to move it. It's just about
it's just a catchy thing to say.
You like to move it, move it. Yes. And about saying physically fit a lot.
I got to say though, and tell me if you guys got this from the song. When I was listening to I Like to Move It, it sounded like he was really obsessed with girls moving it and girls dancing. But I wish that all of his verses were about how much he likes to dance. Because saying I like to move it, I don't know, it was confusing for me.
Because in the verse, he's definitely being like, here are all these beautiful women. And
I like the way they move it.
I want them to know that I also like to move it. I feel like maybe that's what it is.
Why wasn't that the catchy chorus?
Because I also like to move it does not fit as well into the rhythm.
I also like to move it. That's super catchy. What's the problem?
No, you're right.
Okay, good.
In the Lemur Dance Club, I think anything goes.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, this is a good segue, Jennifer, because I, as many people, I think, or possibly, don't know much about lemurs. I didn't know much about Fusa either, which is how they pronounce it in the movie, so I assume that that's a correct pronunciation. But I watched a video of lemurs getting high off of millipedes.
Interesting. I don't know about that, but it sounds like a pretty unique evolutionary behavior. Lemurs are pretty interesting, actually, and I'm no expert, so I'll preface this by saying everything I'm about to say I learned on Wikipedia this morning. But Madagascar, you know, used to be a part of the megacontinent Gondwanaland, and about 160 million years ago, it separated off. And then it separated again into what is now known as India, the Seychelles, and Madagascar. And so lemurs were around. They're kind of an earlier version of primates, which is, you know, we are a part of that as well. And I think they were doing pretty well around the continent until monkeys came online. And monkeys started basically driving them out and towards extinction. But by that time, the lemurs of Madagascar were already well off their way, floating on this beautiful island. And so they've evolved in isolation for 60 million years. And now there's over 100 different species of lemur. It's something called evolutionary radiation, which is the process of basically heaps of diversifying species that all come from the same common ancestors.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because radiation to me...
I think it's a good thing.
Oh, so similarly to sound the alarms...
It's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
Well, it results in over 100 different species of lemurs. And I think that at one point they were sometimes as big as gorillas.
Whoa.
But when humans arrived, we quickly handled those larger lemurs. And now we have roughly 120, but it's hard to be certain because there's always new species being found as we dig into the genes and taxonomies. But super cool creatures.
Yeah, definitely. But an odd movie in general. Can we all agree with that? I don't know how you guys feel about this, but maybe just too many pop culture references. Every 5-10 minutes, they were referring to another movie. There was an American Beauty sequence or homage, which was like the second time in the movie that they were insinuating that Alex the Lion wants to like romantically hook up with a steak.
This movie was frustrating to me because as a writer, there's a lot of things that you will get notes on that you are told that you have to do in a movie. And this movie doesn't do any of them. This movie is like, basically the first act is they're going to be at the zoo. And then they're going to be on an island, and then they're going to, I guess, stay on the island, and that's forever. Well,
except right at the end, I guess, where they decide, like, let's actually tour the world, and then the movie just ends.
But they don't, because then the penguin's like, actually, you can't. The boat's out of gas, and you stay on the island.
Right, yeah, that's true. That's true. It was an odd movie. It seems like a lot of, you know, we've done kids' movies, like Air Bud, for example, the one you were on, Zach, is a good example of this, I'd say, where it's kind of entertaining for the adults as well. They're kind of looking out for both. And for me, this one was way more just like, no, we're going for kids, 1000% foot on the gas, kids movie.
Yeah, which is interesting, though, because they do have Alex having some psychedelic episodes, like whenever he gets tranquilized. There's one, I think, when he first gets darted, and it goes on like a really trippy Willy Wonka-themed psychedelic escapade, which I was totally for.
Yeah. That was probably one of the best parts of the movie.
The zebra had a treadmill at the beginning, which was good because his pen was very small.
I wanted to ask about that too. Like, are there zoos that exist that look anything like this? Like, the zoo, to me, there was no enclosures, really.
Alex the lion does his show where he's sort of just like inches away from the public on a podium.
Just like dancing around. And that all the animals could all visit each other also.
Except for the penguins, because when they did it, they were breaking the rules.
Right. Which was also strange to like, okay, we got to break out of here by digging, but also there's no enclosures. And also, they all leave.
The other animals just leave to go find the first one. This is the thing I'm talking about, where like, I feel like I've been in note sessions where they're like, well, the internal logic of this movie doesn't match up. And they were like, we don't care.
We don't care at all.
These animals are going to be wherever we want them to be.
Don't you think you would have gotten a note of like, hey, Zach, you know that lions walk on four legs, right, dude?
I do. I think I would have gotten that note. And then I would have gotten the note also about the hippo, because the hippo is walking, the hippo and the lion are walking on two legs. The two horses are walking on four legs.
I mean, did that bother you, Jennifer? Did you feel like, why wouldn't they just get the basics down?
You know, I didn't actually really think about it that deeply. But I mean, to the point about, do zoos really look like this? I've never been to the like Central Park Zoo, but I did grow up going to the San Diego Zoo, which, if you remember, when they first land on Madagascar, Alex is like tripping out because he's worried he's going to have to compete with Shamu, which was the resident, you know, it was like the killer whale that did all the acrobatics and stuff. And I was so obsessed with Shamu when I was little. But I think it's pretty common for zoos to celebrate their flagships. You know, like when they have a really cool species in a zoo, they definitely do promote it, because that's what people love, right? I mean, people love the lions and tigers and bears and pandas. And some of my colleagues did a study on trying to understand the attributes of what makes a species charismatic. And so they put together this huge database of all of these kind of mostly terrestrial vertebrates, mammals, and they looked at all of these things like body size, and do they have fur? Do they have hair? Do they have claws? Like, how big are their teeth? And they found that it's body size and forward-facing eyes that are the two primary like triggers of what humans deem to be charismatic.
So like big.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true for me, because when you were talking about ancient lemurs, my first thought was like, I'm so mad that I haven't gotten to see a lemur that's the size of a gorilla.
Mm-hmm. That was your first thought?
I'm so angry that I don't get to see a big gorilla with a big stripy tail swinging around light
poles. That pisses me right off.
I'm so angry about that.
To me, that means they're kind of human-esque. Is that why we dig it, you think?
Totally. We like anthropomorphize, and then that's what we end up giving our money to. So those species tend to get like a larger proportion of, you know, donations from the public and things like that.
Oh boy. I mean, I guess it's just tougher for them to raise money for, you know, the conservation of ugly animals.
Yeah. I mean, you would think that, but we're so good at marketing now. I mean, you could sell anything. Mm-hmm. So I think that there have been some studies that looked at, you know, with a dedicated marketing campaign, where you can celebrate cool stuff, like this frog has its babies in its mouth, and isn't that cool? Give money to this species. That you can like pull out interesting characteristics about almost anything, and then improve people's willingness to give, and also just their general concern over species that might not be the classic storybook animals that you see in, you know, zoos.
I mean, I hate to be narcissistic here or self-promotive, but Zach, I feel like the two of us could make a whole campaign for this. Like, I would love to be a part of a project that just raises money for
a garbage animal. We take the worst animal and be like, listen,
but needs to be conserved.
We need to do the sea bass revamp.
Right.
On what's that fish called? The horrible fish.
There's
the
so many horrible fish, man, to choose from. We have albums worth of material, and we basically make like I Like to Move It type catchy pop songs. But, you know, the whole thing is just telling you, like, please, you know, contribute some money to a FOSSA or whatever, a FUSA.
Well, FUSA are cats, and I feel like all cats pretty much have the internet on lock. They're fine.
Oh, good call.
Everyone's
no need.
Gonna bend over backwards.
Well, wait a minute. Can I ask about that? I was curious if it is most like a cat, because I read it also has a really long tail, like a monkey, and its ears are like a weasel's ears. So, like, what is a FUSA?
Yeah, so it is an endemic carnivore, which sadly, you know, carnivores tend to get typecast as the villains, of course, which is what happened in Madagascar as well in the film.
So unfair.
It is so unfair. But they're actually more closely related to the mongoose.
Really?
Okay.
Wow.
Well, maybe they do need our help then. But I feel like I already know, I know where this branding is going. It's, look at this cool cat. People
right,
like
we're gonna make it a cat for the branding, yeah, for the commercial.
Well, that's what I was saying with the I forget what that kind of sea bass is that isn't a sea bass. Hold on.
Yeah, let's get to the bottom of this. But the fossils are interesting. I mean, Madagascar has so much crazy biodiversity. It is considered one of the biodiversity hotspots of the world. Over 90% of its species are only found there. So it's a really unique place. And that's because it's evolved in isolation for 60 million years or so. So you get these incredible species there that are found nowhere else.
And we should like stay away, right? Is the lesson that we have learned as humans. If we want them to sort of keep kicking around, we should not go to Madagascar.
Yeah, sadly, a lot of the species and the biodiversity of Madagascar, like many other places in the world, the biodiversity is declining. Species are under increasing threat. I know I'm such a bummer to talk to. I'm really going to need your levity.
Everyone needs to learn to take care of Madagascar.
So. Are we going there? Is that why? Are we the ones ruining it over and over again?
Well, it was interesting in the movie how they celebrate it as the kind of this, you know, wild natural place, but there's actually 26 million people that live in Madagascar.
Jesus Christ.
Who are suspiciously absent from this movie.
Totally absent from the movie. But hey, I mean, doesn't Chris Rock's character, Marty, like the first thing he does, he's like, I want to go to the wild. He arrives in this wonderful place. They get through it all. And then at the very end, like, he has his dream. He's finally there. And what does he choose to do? He opens up a tiki bar.
Not only that, but constructs a thing that would be difficult in my brain for a zebra to do. There's a lot of levers and pulleys and electrical lights that come on in the sort of reveal.
He's got it down pretty quick, too. It didn't feel like much time went by.
Yeah. And listen, it's a cartoon.
Sure.
I'm okay with that. If a zebra wants to build a tiki bar and everyone spits seawater in each other's faces, this is good writing and I don't have any notes for it. That's good.
I prefer it over the lion walking on two legs the whole time. If I have to pick one.
Okay, I looked it up and I have actual information now.
Here
we go. The Chilean sea bass, which you will see on menus everywhere, is actually a Patagonian toothfish. And it's this ugly, ugly fish. It's a deep sea fish. It's not a bass, but it tastes good. But they had a lot of problems selling it because it's such an ugly fish.
Oh, no.
So they rebranded it as the Chilean sea bass. Again, not a bass. And we can do that for the FUSA.
Yes.
It's the Madagascar
cat.
Well, I was going to throw in another word there because Madagascar cat is
Madagascarian night cat.
The Madagascarian night cat.
I mean, now, sounds cool.
Now I'm thinking, okay, let's get an NFL team to raise awareness. Who's got a bad one? Let's change out any of the ones based on, you know, indigenous populations of America. You could now be the Madagascarian night cat.
I mean, the Jets, I don't really follow football, but I have a feeling they're not great or something. So
the Jets?
Yeah, so maybe we could have like the New York Madagascarian night cats.
I mean, you got the tie-in because everyone in this movie is a New Yorker.
There you go.
All these animals can read the paper, but not speak English.
Again, the internal logic, let's not dive into it too deep. All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
I did want to ask, speaking of fish, the Chilean sea bass specifically, I guess, there was an article in the National Geographic that you co-wrote, Jennifer, in 2015 entitled, "What Are We Actually Protecting in the Ocean?" And I have to ask about it because I just saw the documentary Seaspiracy on Netflix. Do you know about this or have you seen this?
I have not seen it.
Okay.
I also haven't seen it, so I will also answer your questions about it.
Yeah, please. I want both of you to answer at the same time. And there's a lot of claims in the movie that were very shocking to me. One of them, for example, is that 46% of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is made up of fishing nets. Like, commercial fishing is the big villain in this movie. And so I wanted to ask you directly if there, like, is such a thing as sustainable fishing, and if we should be consuming seafood at all, or should that be over for our species?
Zach, why don't you take this one?
Okay, listen, Zach.
The ocean is so big, right? And there's a lot of fish in it. And now
good opening.
There's a lot of fish in the ocean. It's very big. Now, we've put a lot of plastic in it. And that plastic is going to end up in these fish. Now, whose fault is that? Is it my fault? A little bit. Is it company's fault? Yes.
It sounds
more.
Like a lot of bit. Yeah,
even
exactly.
More. And if there's one thing that I've learned about companies recently is that they love to sort of shift the blame to me. For example,
right.
Recently learned that most of the recycling numbers that you see on the bottom of plastic, anything over 2, most places is actually not recyclable.
What?
So you put like a 3 or a 4 or a 7 into a recycling bin and they're going to throw it away. And the fact that those things are labeled with a recycling symbol at all is the result of the recycling industry or the plastics industry being like, hey, listen, we can make this seem like it's not the fault of us for making plastic. It's these guys for not throwing it away. And so I'm inclined to say that I can eat as much fish as I want and that it's a company's fault for fishing so much. Is that right? I don't stand by that I just thought of.
It's an interesting argument. Agreed on the wish cycling. Guilty as well. You know, this idea that we could just kind of throw anything. I was like 2 years ago, I realized that I really just have to stop putting my plastic bags into the recycling because they end up just choking the machines and they aren't recyclable.
Which is crazy, right? Because you would think if there was anything that we had figured out how to recycle, it would be basically the paper of plastic, which is plastic bags.
It's
like, how are we not just melting those down?
I know.
We do burn a lot of plastic, and a lot of plastic ends up in the oceans. You know, where you do have good, like decent, reliable garbage and recycling systems, the plastic ends up going into a landfill and not into the ocean. There are regions in the world that don't have a very functioning garbage collection and recycling systems. And that's where the proliferation of single-use plastic is really causing a problem. I have spent a lot of time in the ocean. I am a scuba diver. I do research in Borneo and in national parks. And plastic is everywhere. And I have noticed that the fish are getting scarcer and scarcer in some parts of the world. So fish are declining, like biodiversity across the board, in every realm, in our freshwater systems, in our lands, in our oceans. Biodiversity is not in a good state. We are, you know, facing both a climate and biodiversity crisis. That is well known. And we have to take some pretty drastic changes to correct course at this point in time. And I do think that what happens in the next 10 years will determine, certainly within our lifetimes, how we end up coping as a race on this planet.
And just to put you on the spot, hot seat, are you prepared to sound the alarms right here on Bad Science?
Are these good alarms?
Good alarms are bad alarms.
These, I think, for the first time on the podcast.
Are you going to celebrate global warming with these alarms?
I think for the first time on the show, These are bad alarms that I'm asking you to sound about commercial fishing. What I was getting inundated with in this film was telling me that they're the ones who are most responsible for killing all these species of fish.
Yeah, there are absolutely sustainable ways to fish. So I think that, you know, the burden, as you were talking about, Zach, it's on all of us. And we do have a role to play in ensuring that we are purchasing sustainable fish, that we're purchasing species that are being, you know, transparently sold, that we know where they're coming from and we know how they're being fished. Alaskan fisheries are some of the best in the world. So if I had to choose between Atlantic farmed salmon or wild caught Alaskan, where I know that they are really regulating those fisheries, I would choose Alaskan caught wild salmon over farmed.
Okay. So now what you're saying, Jennifer, is harder than what I was saying, though, right? Because what I was saying was that it's not my fault and I don't have to pay attention. It's just corporations' fault. And what you're saying is that may be true, but also you do have to pay attention. And even if you're not the biggest problem, it is important for all of us to do our part.
Yeah, I don't think you can recuse yourself from the purchasing power and the decisions that you make, sadly.
That's fair. I'm going to sit in the chair of the big fishing corporations real quick, because Ethan, you notably did not invite any of them on this podcast. So I feel it's only fair if someone speaks for them.
Correct. And no one better than you. So please.
Yeah, I think I'm in a position to do this, and they did pay me for being here. And I do legally need to say that.
Sure. Zach Reno here on behalf of Dolphin Safe Tuna.
Go ahead. On behalf of Big Fish. The thing about the ocean is it's big, and if we don't take a lot of these fish out of the ocean, we're going to have too many fish.
Yeah, they're going to evolve, and they're going to come on land.
And you should be afraid. That's right. Yep. And you should be afraid of what will happen if we, Big Fish, are not protecting all of you from
little fish.
Because you like tuna, but you don't like too many tuna. And you may not know that, but we do. And we have scientists that we paid to give us the numbers that we sort of wanted to see.
Right.
And we stand by those.
So yeah, so just a review here, because I guess I'll play kind of the just bipartisan, you know, middle of the road guy here. Dr. Jennifer McGowan telling you, pay some attention, look up where your food's coming from, and then Big Fish representative Zach Reno.
Doesn't matter where they come from, eat as many as possible before they come for our children, our schools, your jobs.
Right. Okay. I'm glad that we have that clear. So moving on to like a really important, well thought out question I came up with. Melman's neck is bent a lot in this movie, the giraffe. And so normally when I see giraffes, their neck is just kind of up, and every now and then they'll lean over a little bit to get something off a tree.
Usually leaves, not just like something.
I don't know what they're doing, like, storing on stuff these in trees, the tree. Man. Can giraffes just walk around with their head, with their necks completely bent the other way all the time?
Are they straight by choice and not because they have to be? Could they have noodle necks all the time?
Yes.
This is such an interesting. I have no idea.
All right, great.
Ethan, no joke.
Yep.
I have a little bit of insight here.
Here we go. And Big Fish representative Zach Reno, please answer my question.
Well, now I'm the official representative of the Santa Barbara Zoo.
Oh, great. Santa Barbara Zoo representative Zach Reno.
Santa Barbara Zoo has a place called Lemur Island, and that's very good and neither here nor there to what I'm about to say. They also had a giraffe with a crooked neck for most of my childhood. And it was the sort of Alex the Lion of the Santa Barbara Zoo was the crooked neck giraffe. So giraffes can live with their necks being all bendy, but I did not get the impression that it was a choice that giraffe was making to be like, what if I just hold my neck like this for a while? I think it was the shape of that giraffe.
More of an ailment, but he could still be a star. He could still be the biggest
giraffe. He was a star to me.
Yeah, exactly. Wanted to be like him when you grew up.
I still do. With proper marketing, even your crooked neck giraffe can be a star. Now, that giraffe in the movie was Jewish, correct? We can say that almost.
He had a Jewish doctor, for sure.
He had a Jewish doctor. Well, I think that at one point he says the giraffe says his last name.
Oh, really?
I'm going to look on IMDb now, but I think he's like Melman something Owitz.
I loved the part where he's like debating what his health insurance coverage is going to be. And he's like terrified of having an HMO.
And those are jokes for adults, Ethan.
Jokes. It had jokes for adults. I don't know. I felt like it was very heavy-handed on the slapstick kid stuff, which, hey, is really fun. And apparently kids love this movie and they made three more of them and a TV show. So, you know, what the hell am I talking about?
I know. Like, they made like five offshoots of it. I was thinking about this earlier today too, because I was trying to figure out like why there wasn't like any conservation messaging in this film.
Great call. Totally.
And I was like, well, what was going on in the world at this point in time? So this was 2005. I was working at a grocery store in San Francisco in 2005, trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And then I remembered like 2005 might have been like right on the precipice of when conservation and kind of climate change really came into like the public domain, because Hurricane Katrina hit right after that. And then we had An Inconvenient Truth from Al Gore coming out, which was, you know, launched climate change into household conversations. And so really, and I think it was like maybe that same year after was the very first episode of the BBC Attenborough Planet Earth series, which was, groundbreaking at that time. And so I think that so much has happened since the first one came out that has now made, I think, conservation and biodiversity and the, you know, crisis that's unfolding before us just a part of the conversation. And I was interested to think about how if they keep going with this, you know, these sequels, like what does Madagascar 20, you know, look like? Because if it comes out in like 25 years, some of the species in the first one might not even be around anymore.
I mean, so sad. And I totally agree with you as far as putting it, like injecting it into the movie. We did Free Willy a while ago on the podcast. And of course, I didn't remember this from when I was little, but rewatching it, there's a text at the end, right at the end of the movie, not, you know, after the credits post thing, like before all of that, there's a message that tells you where you can donate to help killer whales. And I just feel like it would be so beneficial to these movies. And I assume they don't do this in the other Madagascar movies, which I have not seen, but it would be so beneficial to just write where people can, you know, get more information or where to go donate, because, you know, this is seen by millions of people every year.
Totally. I mean, it shapes, I grew up, I'm a product of the 80s. So I was heavily influenced by a movie called Fern Gully when I was a young girl.
Oh,
I
don't remember. Are you kidding? Same, same.
Yeah. And that was very environmentally messaged. And so that was in my, you know, very young adolescent brain, along with Reduce, Reuse, and Recycle, which I think kind of emerged at the time we were, at least I was, in elementary school.
Pollution is the literal villain in Fern Gully. There's a big deforesting pollution machine, and it's killing all the fairies. And that, even as a kid, I was like, I'm on the fairy side here. I know this guy.
And the villain was scary,
and
too.
Robin Williams is in that movie as a genetically altered bat.
Yep,
that's
correct.
Like, there's an anti-animal testing message there that is somewhat undercut by the fact that he is very funny.
It's a great film. And I love that it was heavy-handed with its messaging. I feel like that's, I don't know, it inspired probably a lot of people to get into this field, which is vital because it makes me so sad that we're losing these species. It's like unacceptable.
Well, you know what will make you happier?
Here we go.
I've got Melman's last name.
Oh, hallelujah. Give it
His
to
name
us.
Is Melman Mankiewicz.
Right. The guy who wrote Citizen Kane.
Yeah, he's the Mank. This is the Mank of giraffes.
This is the real Mank. All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
The break is over. Here we go. The show about science.
I wanted to actually ask a question about the penguins. I love penguins, always have. And the penguins in this movie, probably my favorite part of the movie.
They're great.
And
they've had their own spin-off series, by the way.
I need to watch that because I really love the penguin parts. And they seem like super smart in this movie, which I appreciated. They were like spies, essentially. So can you accomplish my dream and just tell me that penguins are like actually really, really smart?
I think smart is relative in the animal kingdom. And I think it really is best positioned to evaluate on like how they cope with problem solving. And penguins, while not the most agile or nimble creatures, despite how they are portrayed in this film as having ninja-like skills.
Assassins, if you will.
Ninja-like assassins. They are really excellent navigators, and they are also known to be extremely clever hunters. So
that's
I think,
true.
Yeah, I think in the water, they might be more ninja-like than they are on land.
Okay, I'll take
it.
Tell you what.
We watched them use a big steering wheel to beat up a lot of predators. And they put a bunch of humans on a lifeboat that they, quote, sent off to China, which, quick calculation from where Madagascar is, the people on that lifeboat are dead, right?
Yeah. I'll speak on behalf of the cartographers of the world to tell you that those people are dead. They are murderers. Those penguins are assassins. We are running short on time, but I have to ask about the hippo as well. Because I started just going down a rabbit hole. I don't know if this happened to you guys, of looking at pictures of hippos and videos of hippos this morning. And I read that their closest living relatives might be pigs or whales and dolphins. So can you give me some information on what the heck this super weird looking animal is?
All I know is that they are hippos. I don't know who their closest relatives are, but I do know that they spend up to 16 hours a day submerged in rivers and lakes, and that's to kind of keep their massive bodies cool under this beating down sun. And that sounds pretty cool to me. I mean, who doesn't love a bath?
I would spend that much time submerged if it was socially acceptable
for me to do so.
I will also say, hippos are real dangerous, right? Like if you like,
it looks like it.
That hippo is putting the lion in its place. And I think I will speak for scientists, which I am not, when I say that that's accurate. And I will also speak for casting departments when I say that this movie is wild in that every character is an animal, basically. And I think there is literally two women in it. One is the hippo and one is the old lady who I think has no lines.
That's correct.
I don't think a single other woman speaks in this movie at any point in time.
I noticed that right away, actually, during the opening sequence where they are writing the actor, like, you know, the cast. And it's just like dude after dude after dude. I'm like, really? But isn't it an animal movie?
They
like,
all could. There's no reason that it's all men. It's wild to me.
Yeah, I thought that was really strange. Maybe they fixed it with the other ones. Again,
that might just be because, and you can tell me if the science is wrong here, I think something like 98% of all animals are men.
I thought you were going to say animators, and I was going to confirm that, but
no, animals. All animals are all giraffes are Jews. Most animals are men.
This has been your Big Fish report from Zach Reno. And wait, so can we get a definitive, or maybe not even definitive, but just a guess on hippo versus lion? Who's taking hippo. Down who here, Dr. McGowan?
I will put my money. What? Ooh, I'll go with you on hippo.
Okay.
You seen the video of a hippo splitting a watermelon with its mouth?
Yeah, Super Jaws.
You know that game Hungry Hungry Hippo where four hippos just destroy plastic pellets?
I love that game.
Yeah.
I don't know why I love that game so much, but
you love
I spent
it because
a long
it
time.
Sparks something that you know true deep within your soul, which is that hippos exist to destroy. With their mouths, they're
always hungry.
They're hungry. They come in bright rainbow colors.
Yep.
And they're constantly on the hunt for food. And their favorite food is, of course, little white pellets that pop up from the ground.
Also, I don't want to overbook us here, Zach. Obviously, I know you're a busy guy, spending 16 hours of your day submerged.
When I can.
But when you can, when socially acceptable. But should we not only make an album promoting ugly animals, but also make the film version of Hungry Hungry Hippos? Because I feel like it's a pretty popular game, you know, brand recognition is high. I would watch that movie.
Shocked if a Hungry Hungry Hippos movie was not currently underway. And if it hasn't,
right.
Ethan,
so we're too late.
If it has not, That is a blank check we should be writing for our to ourselves.
Dr. McGowan, would you serve as like science supervisor on Hungry Hungry Hippos for us? Well, can we get you on the team?
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Okay, well, listen, thank you both for joining me today. This has been fascinating and super fun. Zach, obviously, people need to be listening to Off Book if they're not currently listening to Off Book. It's one of my favorite podcasts of all time.
Oh, thank you so much.
Where can people find you? Is there anything else you'd like to tell people about?
Yeah, go to your grocery store and just buy the fish. Don't pay too much attention to where it comes from. And corporations always have your best interest in mind. That's why they're big and rich. And that's sort of the sort of thing that I will leave you with.
Wow. Wonderful words. Just a nice, warm, comforting message there to leave us with. Dr. Jennifer McGowan, would you like to tell people about anything?
Well, I don't have anything specific to say, except that it's not too late to change course for the planet. And we still have some time, but the decisions that we make every day will have an impact. And we need to hold those corporations, as well as businesses and ourselves, accountable for what happens.
Okay, super dramatic, aggressive calling out. Lightning round section. What are the worst organizations? Who's on your list? Who are you throwing darts at?
Your mom and pop corner store. Just like the one guy fishing with a single pole on the dock.
Yeah.
Late at night.
Or Buca de Pepo. Up to you.
Did you say Buca de Pepo?
Yeah, for some reason, I just feel like, I don't know, man. It's a shadowy place.
Is Buca de Pepo the villainous cousin to Buca de Beppo?
Oh, am I saying the name wrong? Is that what happened?
I don't know. I don't like to call people out on what could be an honest mistake. I just am interested in this restaurant, Buca de Pepo.
They only serve pepperoni-based
And Chilean sea bass.
Well, that can't be good for the environment.
Okay, well, you know, write us from your local Buca de Pepo, and thank you both for joining me. Hopefully we can speak again about one of these Madagascar sequels.
Can't wait.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bad Science is a Seeker podcast produced by Emily Feld and me, Ethan Edinburgh. Our editor is Lucas Bollinger, and our social media is managed by Blue Whale Media. Shout out to EJ and Kate.
And the executive Pradaskar producer is Brett Kushner.
Oh, follow us on Instagram at BadSciencePod. If there's a movie you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, feel free to email at badscience@seeker.com. That's badscience@seeker.com. And please leave us an iTunes review. Give us 5 stars. I sound like an Uber driver. But it does help. It makes sure people know about the podcast, which we really appreciate. Thanks for listening. Bye.